Ben Paddy, yeah. Simon.
Can you stand up and speak? Otherwise, we'll lose it.
I think it's more on the question regarding the discussion side of it, I'm afraid. Quite difficult to do this, but I completely disagree with this argument on how we go to live in socialism as a socialist, what I signed up for. This is like some sort of camel with dream socialism. Yeah? I mean, we're not meant to plan the cookshops of the future, not just because we don't have the knowledge to do it, because we're not going to run it like the same cookshop. I mean, this isn't turning capitalism on its head. This is putting capitalism to rights. It's just running capitalism without capitalism, without this money system, but because it exploits us through the ruling class. Yeah? It's fetishizing the problem as well. It's creating this transitional state of socialism, yeah? Of saying, well, everyone's going to be still focused on the problem of production, the problem of democracy. There's a whole bunch of socialism is to get rid of these problems so we can get on with our life activity rather than always having our lives focused by the problems at hand, which is what we have now, because we have to go to work and go to bed just because we need the things to live on. Yeah? Whereas socialism is going to be different. It's going to be about solving the problem of production in order to live. It's like a government of national salvation. You turn around and say, well, look, the world is in this problem. We've got all these problems. Yeah? We need to solve these problems. Therefore, what we need this government's going to do this. We're going to make major alterations to capitalism. But it assumes that people are going to have this capitalist mindset while they're doing it. People are going to stretch everything to limits, that you have to have a very strict democratic structure, and every single decision is going to go by the line, going to be voted on here, there, and everywhere. Rather than people just turning around and saying, yes, well, gave this person a limit to do it, they're not being undemocratic, so they just get on with it so we can do something better by time than sit around voting all the time. I don't really know how else to put it. This is like an antique version of socialism. I didn't turn up for this. You know, this is 19th century theory, because in the 19th century, really, they're just getting to the point of having close to this game, only in small areas of the Western world. So this was a real focus. They were thinking, well, we're going to get socialism, but for generations on end, our lives are just going to be focused towards solving the production problem. Because now it's a matter of dealing with the artificial crisis that capitalism gives us, to get through a couple of harvests, to get through a couple of production cycles, and deal with the problems in order that then we deal with the proper abundance rather than the potential abundance that we have.
Thank you, Simon. That's given a lot of people a lot to think about. Actually, I think the topic in general was, we'll do this, it is a very fruitful topic. Stan?
I've got a lot of sympathy with what Simon just said. But I think I'd be a bit more sort of in agreement with a lot of what Peter said, because I do like such statements as the idea of the post-critical analysis of capitalism, moving on to, say what's going to take its place. He mentioned earlier that diversity would be welcome. I was a bit worried about his reference to dealing with troublemakers, but I'm afraid I might be one of the troublemakers he will make a bit of.
We'll sort you out.
However, I am, I think, like Simon, very much aware that this picture painted by Peter is very, very sort of capitalism influence. I mean, to me, it lacks imagination. And the one thing we really must have is to be able to imagine, not in a kind of dismissive, or rather not the sort of thing that Peter criticized, more to the idea that the kind of idealistic look at the future. Marx said we don't write recipes for future culture. But unless we do start to think about the ingredients of socialist food about the daily capital, we've got to have imagination about the changes which will happen within capitalism between now and the time when there's 51% or more of socialism. And I think this is a matter of speculation. None of us knows the future. But let's at least imagine what it would be like. Just take three examples. Education. What would it be like when we're educated in socialist ways instead of being very largely educated by capitalist institutions? Secondly, what would it be like when we have newspapers, journals, publications which are at least 50% pro-social instead of 0.5% social? And thirdly, I'd say trust. Today, we don't trust each other because we live in capitalism. A lot of what Peter's saying, we're still not trusting. Peter wants us to adapt machinery, which is basically, to control. We've got to have much more trust that when there's a large even a small majority of soldiers, we're going to have a society of trust, not a society of all these sort of capitalist arrangements, which Peter wants to take over and adapt to. So really, it's lack of imagination. We must have more.
John?
With reference to representation, it's the Socialist Labour Party's position that representation should come from where people work, because they will take advantage of what they know best, of where they are trained. And if you were saying, well, what is the problem in saying production of automobiles? Do you want to do away with the car, etc., etc.? Well, the people that are working in that industry are the ones that would be, for the moment, most capable of answering a question like that. Equally so with steel production, with housing, and so on. So, as the Socialist Labour Party, it would be doing away with representation on a geographical constituency, where a person goes to vote today, he may be a carpenter, a lawyer, or an architect, or a steel worker, or whatever, and they're voting for a politician. We would say tomorrow, that worker would work in his place of work for a position or a condition that is being set forth saying, shall we have this, that, or the other, as far as production is concerned. So, right away, you're dealing with something where capitalist despotism really prevails, and then obviously it spills over to other aspects of life. So, solving the problem of production in a democratic way, then we would start with trust and whatever. But I can't see any form in a new society without that tackling the despotism that capitalism had in the field of production. And by the way, I did bring a couple of copies of the paper, and on page 4 there's a very brief outline of the economic.
And you've left some copies at the back, haven't you, John?
Yes, but I'll take them in the train and read them.
Thank you. Paddy?
I'd like to speak up, Peter. We're being put in a clever stick here. We're all acting, it seems like, we're acting like the Grand Inquisitors that on the one hand try and bait Peter into a heresy that we can then burn him at the stake for. In this particular case, he's going to get burnt. He's also going to get burnt at the stake if the heresy is not interesting enough for us. He's being accused of not being imaginative enough, but really what he's doing is playing safe, because as he himself pointed out, the party regards this kind of thing as sin. We don't go into this speculation. So what's Peter supposed to do? You can't accuse him of being not imaginative enough, when at the same time the whole process of speculation is inherently dangerous. So I think that's unfair. So, of course, Peter's model is based on the real world that we know now. Perhaps it isn't as imaginative as it might be. I nevertheless think that it's a bit more progressive than the sort of workerist position of placing all democracy in the workplace, which is the SRP position. I find that deeply uncomfortable, the idea that people are defined by their workplace. After all, in socialism, people wouldn't have a workplace, people wouldn't be doing the same work. The idea that car workers now should be consulted about whether they want to, how they want to run car manufacturing socialism, I think it's insulting to the people who are doing the car work, the work now. The only idea that they're going to continue to work in those revolting factories after socialism is a complete non-starter. Finally, I'd just like to throw my particular view into the equation, ask Peter what he thinks about. If there is a problem with his model, that I see it, is that it's too static and it doesn't take sufficient account of the fact that people will be moving around the earth much faster, much more frequently than they've ever done before. The reason why I would maintain that people are so static is because economic conditions force them to stay in the same place. I would ask him to consider a form of democracy that could work with a very highly mobile population.
Could I put in, before I ask Peter to reply to these, could I put in a plea for a more cautious use of the word imagination? I suppose this comes from reading poetry in the past, and people like Wordsworth and Coleridge distinguished between two processes of thought which were closely related, what they called imagination and fantasy. Now, when you talk about constructing utopian fairy tales, that would, according to Wordsworth, be fantasy. That would be just spinning ideas out of your head. Imagination is much more focusing down and trying to perceive in a mental way what things might be like. And I prefer, when I'm talking about the possibilities of socialism, to talk about extrapolation rather than simply spinning ideas. If you've got common ownership, if you've got a democracy, democratic control, other things follow. They are extrapolatable. And that's where you use your imagination to make sure that you are sticking to the guidelines. What, now, that Peter has used his imagination, and he's used it quite hard to extrapolate what he's said. I mean, I would agree with some of the criticisms that what he's not shown is a dynamic model, but that's a big job, you know. However, carry on, Peter.
I'd rather just sum up in the end, if you mind.
All right, leave it to the end, yes. So, Peter, then Vic, then
I would Alan.
Right, I hope I remembered.
We'll remember.
Okay.
You've mentioned that you would still retain, or you would advocate, or you would expect to retain the ethos of Parliament and other administration at not only at national and local levels. I find myself at difficulty with this. Isn't it one of the tenets of the party's manifesto that we should dismantle the machinery of government, which is a very poignant. But not once have you used the word delegate. And that has surely been the party's case, that we should delegate people, we should appoint delegates, authorized by us, authorized by common consent, to administer those areas, both production and the necessities of life, health, and whatever else society decides. And I also agree with the previous speaker, who said there will be a far greater accent on mobility. We then may not wish to spend our life in a small village, or in our present time, which are mostly dictated by economic necessities. So I would have thought that, as I say, I feel extremely uncomfortable with you saying, with you postulating, that we would still keep Parliament and parish councils, albeit in a somewhat reformed way.
And it was Vic next, I think, wasn't it? Correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Well, Peter's always been much more interested in this sort of thing than I've been. Never bothered me all that much. At worst, my view has been that what will happen in the future society will become much more apparent as this time draws on. And it's just speculation at this stage. Mind you, what Peter has said sounded pretty reasonable to me. But then again, I don't know any better, because it's not something that I concern myself with. And what strikes me about it all is how much of what Peter has said will be overtaken by events in the future. Now, I don't object to discussions and, once again, speculation like this. I don't object to it. What I do object to is if it ever gets presented, as some people would like, some members would like, if it ever gets presented as the party case. And I don't object to it also unless it's as attempts made on the basis of it to foist it on the party an angle of comfort or some party pole or something like that. So I was quite happy with what Peter said.
Alan?
Yes, well, I found Peter's comment very interesting, and speculation on the form of future social society would take. I had one or two minor reservations. That's all. I don't think, for example, in when he was describing the functions of local authorities,
I think it's important to bear in mind that as well as services like health and education and so on, they are also centering from what you could call repression and coercion of the working class, insofar as local authorities are closely associated with controlling the police force. And of course, a socialist society would have no truck with these people. And I could imagine that the only thing that we might keep were their vehicles, and that's their communication. But I'm sure that was an oversight on Peter's part. The second line of reservation I had was with the use of the word national to describe units in a future society. Now, this might have been merely a loose use of language. I can see what Peter's getting at, and obviously it didn't mean that future units would bear any resemblance to the political units that are all around us today in capitalist society. But because I could see, I mean, one could speculate that to me it appears that future societies might be organized around what you could call cultural groups, which are to a very great extent in today persecuted. I had in a day or two, I was reading something about the Breton people of northwest France, and apparently in French government buildings until quite recently, they used to have notices saying that spitting on the floor and speaking Breton is prohibited. And the Breton people, ancient Celtic cultural group, have undergone years of repression from the French state. And the French state, like all capitalist states, is composed of various cultural and language groups who, in a future society, when these political states are gone, might well choose to organize themselves in a totally different fashion than the territorial and political units that we see around us today. I could imagine, for example, certainly France breaking up into Brittany breaking away, maybe Normandy, maybe just speculate. There's a language in the south, I think it's called Occitan, is it something like that? 8 million people spent, again, you know, I mean, Welsh has been if not persecuted, well, it has been persecuted in the 19th century. It's a famous novel, How Green Was My Valley. And the hero goes to school in the next valley, and because he's Welsh speaking and he's got an English master, he's beaten for being Welsh. And the author was there representing something that was quite commonplace. So, I don't see, I see future society as being rather more slanted towards these kind of groupings.
Thank you. Richard?
Too many Richard.
Yes. Well, yeah, but you tend to call yourself Dick, he tends to call himself Richard, but...
Well, I think sometimes we get a bit confused by pure terminology and semantics. For me, there's very little difference, for instance, between the delegate and the representative. That's truly representative of what people want. They're delegated to represent something. I find that, what does it matter? What I was surprised to hear from people is they... division he made between that concept and participatory democracy. I cannot see why one negates the other. Why such a system of delegates could not involve absolute maximum participation from the community. But when it came to actual nitty-gritty administration, then it would, of course, be done by those chosen to do it. Nor do I find a problem with using the existing structures of society which admits a society. I mean, after all, what is Parliament? Parliament is a building. I mean, the structures of Parliament are not... Peter has never suggested, I think, that we would retain a House of Commons in the way we've got it now. Not at all. But after all, it's true that there's going to be local democracy. It's true there's going to be cultural choices made
But there's also going to have to be global decisions taken concerning the environment, concerning distribution and use of products and things like this. I don't see why, again, those things are separated because they're all part of the same society. What I would, pick up from Peter is that, having said all that, what most upsets me about what he said, having made all those agreements, is that he, I believe he did use his imagination, but he was dismissive of what he called utopian imagination. And here I would totally disagree with him. It is quite right that such use of speculation must never be the parting place. How can it be? But I've always maintained, and still do, that without exercising our imagination about possible, what Peter calls utopian situations, I say that imagination is part of the process of getting from one place to another. If you want to go mountaineering and be solid and safe about it, you get on the old irons and the old pickaxe and you go to Clapham Common because you know you can manage it. But then on the other hand, that can't stop you from imagining you might try something more difficult. And at the same time, while it's true that we have to look at the practical aspects of a future society, that should never inhibit our imagination to see how we can go beyond those practicalities and using the practicalities as the basis, exercise our imagination to see how our lives can be enhanced even greater.
Dick, the other Richard? Yes.
Well, the thing about it is Peter, in my view, gave a viewpoint, the party's viewpoint, was in line with the Declaration of Principles. He said, let's not speculate. What he had to say was very sensible. I'm astonished that anybody would go up and say, what's this magic and thingy, unimaginative and that. He was just perfectly in line. As far as I'm concerned, he gave the official party case on the subject, which surprised me, by the way, because I don't have personal discussion. He could speculate as much as that. And in a sense, it's a wee bit disappointing because I wanted to speculate. And his first words, he said, this is not speculation. I went, oh, no. That means that Victor Vanney and I can't argue here because what I want to do is pull down all the cathedrals inside socialism. He wants to get more painted up and modernised.
Floodlit.
What?
Floodlit.
And floodlit. Right, sorry. I don't know what he wants to do with the other monuments to human beings' gullibility and that, where he wants that for the to floodlight prisons as well. What a beautiful 19th century institution there and how well built they are. And the hangman's noose and all that's really well constructed. But anyway, it stopped us doing that, unfortunately. But I mean, if in 1904, when the 100 or 200 or so men and women of the working class got together, and if they did indulge in speculation, and I imagine they did, I mean, what did they say to workers? Did they say, oh, inside socialism, you'll have your own handsome cab. Inside socialism, everybody will have their own gaslight. Because that would be the kind of world they had, wouldn't it? I mean, if they said to them in 1904, and inside socialism, you'll be able to see images that are happening in the other part of the world in full colour. If they said to them, you'll be able to speak to your brother who lives on the other side of the world. You'll be able, you know, and you went on with all the modern technological advances, they'd lock you up, wouldn't they? You'd say, this man's mad if he'd said that. So, while it's very pleasant and worthwhile, and I enjoy it, I enjoy nothing more than speculating, especially after a couple of pints. But really, what Peter's done is he's given a straightforward party case. I'm not going to read it out, but you know what it says in clause 6, you've probably all looked at it, as I'm doing for the first time for many years. And it does say that our viewpoint is that we've got to organise consciously and politically for the conquest of the powers of government, national and local. In other words, what we'll have to do, who knows what the future holds. I mean, we didn't have a European Parliament then, did we? No, we didn't.
Nor a Scottish Assembly.
Pardon?
Nor a Scottish Assembly.
No, we didn't have that bugger either, no. But the thing about it is that we still hold by this, don't we? This is a working proposition, as far as we know about the future. And what Peter has dealt with, I think, is in line with very much the classical, if you like, part of the case. Now, on the question of how would it work, I don't know, I'm not sure if Peter wrote it. If he didn't write it, he wrote most of it. Socialism is a practical alternative, which I think you did, didn't you, Peter? Mm-hmm. You're very much involved. If you didn't write every word, you wrote most of them. Some of which I find much more speculative than what Peter said here today, and some of which I'm not 100% sure of. But basically, it is the party case. It better be, otherwise we'd have to withdraw the pamphlet. He certainly said nothing other than that, and I'm surprised that Simon, you know, getting his knickers really in a frankel about magic and... completely out of order, in my viewpoint. You can come back when we come in, if I'm out of order.
Not while I'm in the chair.
Right, sorry. Now, to me there's three things here. To me there's three things here, and I think Peter's covered them basically. First is the big issues, the really one. If tomorrow we get world socialism, and we've got to answer this, and by the way, it seems ridiculous. There's about 40 of us here, there was 50 of us last year, and that. You know, it's no question that nobody can get in here, and here we're discussing, you know, a socialist society. But nevertheless, it's worthwhile in this sense, if people ask us what our aim is, we should have an answer. So I think the basic answer is the one that we really all have given. Namely, the big issues when we first get a socialist majority throughout the globe is to feed the hungry. It's as simple as that, isn't it? And that's going to take a tremendous amount of worldwide organisation. Even if it's just to transport the existing food we've got and bring all those ships out of mothballs, you know, and get all these storehouses to places it's needed. Then, having done that, a major one is the question of people living in substandard housing. You know, comrades in India, for instance, when we were there having meetings out Sealdah Station in Calcutta, the lucky workers, the lucky people in that town were those who had a pitch inside the railway station to lie in and bring up their kids. The unlucky ones were those who had to spend 3 months of a downpour in a monsoon, bringing up their family, living on the street. It's incomprehensible how some workers live throughout the world. Now, that has got to be a major one. But what, and by the way, it's a really amazing one, isn't it? I mean, that's going to take a lot of human resource and imagination in order to deal with it. Then, of course, we come to the proposition, the big day-to-day issues. And this is where I would disagree with what John's saying in the Dandelion viewpoint of industrial unionism. It's not up to factory workers manufacturing motor cars to decide what kind of motor car or whether we produce motor cars. It's up to society as a whole, not people who are accidentally pursuing a particular pursuit. Maybe we'll not have any motor cars inside socialism. Okay, come on. I feel like chairman, you know. Don't interrupt me. Right, and the other proposition is that it is, of course, industrial unionism a 19th century concept insofar as hardly anybody now pursues one trade and sticks with it all their life and has all this expertise. Most workers now, or I say most workers, a large percentage of them are now in short-term contracts who not only move from factory to factory, actually move from country to country pursuing employment. I would imagine that inside socialism, and now if I can just have one last bit of speculation come at you, that Great Britain, so-called Great Britain, will become a bird sanctuary. The tourists will come to it and say, look at that, it's marvelous. Because only penguins and seagulls would want to live in an area of the Clyde Coast so it's bloody freezing 9 months, it's in a rain all the time. People say, well, we must go and live there, you know. I would imagine that quite a lot of people would say, bugger this, living in Alaska, it's too cold. Yeah. Now, I mean, I see nothing wrong with that. I mean, what happened is people have been forced to live there, haven't they, ever since the human race has come out of Africa. We'll now be able to decide where we live and how long we live there. Inside a situation where we're very, very fluid and all that, we would have to have very loose geographical arrangements locally. What Peter has pursued here, as far as I'm concerned, avoiding, amazingly, all sorts of speculation, is restated the party case. Well done, Peter.
Dougie, and then Vincent.
What has been said about, you know, representation and participation, I'd just like to put one problem that might come about in democracy. Everything which is wonderful, I think, but there's going to be some aspects of democracy where there's conflicts of interest. You mentioned an airport. Say some people don't want more planes because of the runway, and the rest of the country wants the airport. So you've got a conflict of interest. Who makes the democratic decision? The whole country or the people that are going to suffer the number of planes? Mm-hmm. So there are still problems even with democracy even when you get it.
Indeed. Vincent?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a general point about what we're doing in this particular session, which I think is very valuable indeed. As Peter said at the end of his talk, that we're almost moving on now, partly from the just the criticism of capitalism. And I think although in the past members have been wary at looking at the future of society and the details because we've known only too well that quite a lot of it is speculation in comparison with our analysis of the existing capitalist society, where we can look at all of the existing social problems and explain why they're happening. Although there is this
hold it a second, Vincent. I don't think it can be heard at the moment. Just wait till he's gone. Okay. I think I could hear now.
Okay. Although there's quite understandably been this reluctance, too much speculation, going into too much detail about the consequences of the future socialist society, I think it is very important, certainly as we present the socialist case to the population at large, that we do indulge, if you like, in giving some details about what socialism is going to be like. Because, is it very important that we do analyse existing capitalist society and expose all of its problems and explain why they occur. But that, to a certain extent, when viewed by people perhaps coming into contact with part for the first time, is the negative side. We're showing all these problems, and if we dwell too much on it can lead to a certain impression of negativity that, say, people coming into contact with the party for the first time might have. So although we obviously have to do that, we obviously have to expose all of the problems that capitalism does present. At the same time, I think we do have to emphasise more of the positive side of our case, which is socialism, and go into some details about showing to people, say, particularly coming into contact with a party for the first time, what the consequences are and the fantastic improvement in the way of life for everybody that socialism would involve. And I think that would help us to appear more attractive to people hearing about our case. What the wonderful improvement could be that socialism would offer.
Thank you, Vincent. One of the reasons I tried to fob the chairmanship off onto somebody else was that this is a topic which interests me very greatly, and I've spent something like 30 years writing at length about it. I won't go into any of that sort of detail. You'll be thankful to learn at this stage. But one plea I would put in, and this is about the nature of revolution. And the only person really that sort of touched on it at all this morning is Simon. Dick, when he was making his points, said, if we were to wake up tomorrow morning, or words to this effect, and find that we've got a socialist society, the thing is, how would we go about these things? Which, of course, is an absolute misuse of the imagination, because that's an impossibility. It conjures an impossibility. It sounds a very ordinary thing to say. In fact, he stated an impossibility. You could not have a revolution in that way at all. And we are talking about a revolution of, what is it, 6 billion now? Or at least a very large majority of them. Revolution is going to be a dynamic process. It's going to be a process of heightening emotion. It's going to be something like, not the same as, something like a religious conversion, something like Mao's Little Red Book. It's going to be something where people are discussing, meeting, planning one plan on top of another, throwing it out. It's going to run for a period of years. Before they even establish the socialist society, they will have decided that they already have enough houses in the world for everybody, except that so many people own 2, 3, and 4. Others stand empty all the winter until somebody else wants to use them during the summer, and why not swap them? There is a fantastic amount of food in the world. In other words, these are not really the difficult problems. The difficult problem is going to be organizing the revolution so that there are few casualties, either literal ones of their lives, or few casualties of facilities, that we don't destroy what we might need in the future, that sort of thing. But it's this emotional element, this organizational excitement which takes place. We've only got to look at what happened in capitalist revolution. Or in the Chartist movement. It took people along with it in excitement. It didn't mean to say they produced chaos. If you look at the meetings in Newall Hill in Birmingham, 250,000 people there, no casualties to speak of, listening to 8 bands and God knows how many platforms of speakers, because they were misplaced. This was not going to be their revolution, as they thought. They were being hoodwinked. But that sort of feeling has accomplished every large movement of people. And this is going to be the largest movement of people ever. Right, anybody else? No, yes, Margaret was first, then Christopher.
But, really, after what you've said, I haven't got much to say. But can I say, Jack, one piece is actually very dull. I don't want a village when we have a revolution. I don't like villages. I like the towns where people can exchange views and do things together. Just sit digging a hole in the ground and living out of life. Look at the problems that Dick has done. We tend to brush over them and say, oh, well, those will be solved. But we shall be left with a mess. And the first thing we should do when we have the revolution is get rid of all those problems. We can't say to people, as I've heard people say on the platform, well, when we have socialism, it'll be like it is now, only it's to run in our interests. We've got to do more than that. And I would like to have had a little bit of excitement in this, that Ron was trying to bring up. I had some more to do, but I waited so long I've forgotten that.
In your particular case, you can come back, okay? Because you've got Kraft disease, like me. Kraft disease. Can't remember that flipping thing.
That's okay.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Yeah, we all get it. Christopher.
Yes. I thought Peter's representation of this was very generous. I mean, you know, how could one not think that it had a sort of generosity? Leaping across the boundaries which exist and seeing beyond those boundaries something different, something new. But what I have against it is the principle. When you're across those boundaries, you're assuming that everything is going to fall into place, that it's going to work, you know, that there are going to be all these people there, all waiting without that tremendous upheaval, the process of upheaval taking place, all ready to do the work of socialism. But in fact, there'll be tremendous opposition and resistance and argument, and it's going to go on for years. Like, for instance, when the aborted ending of the Russian Revolution took place, the beginning of it was absolute upheaval in the streets of St. Petersburg, people talking and collaring each other all over the place, and then trying to make something of it. But, you know, what happens after that? How do you organize? How do you organize these millions of people? You know, it is a process which one has to be very careful. You know, the reason why I brought up Umberto Eco was for one reason alone. That is that we have to see all this. The upheavals taking place, and the irrationality and the rationality and the interaction between the irrational and the rational is going to take place. But, and then somebody says, the only trouble is, you've got to watch out. Beware of those who are faking. How can you tell the difference between those who are faking and those who are not faking? Do you do it by, say, the organizational structure that lies behind it, you know, that which is beyond the individual, and therefore you can do it without that. And it was the same as the Coleridge thing, you see. If you're not careful, you drink of the milk of paradise and you find you're floating somewhere. You're floating somewhere in an atmosphere where reality has disappeared. That's what I was thinking. And the generosity is there, but watch out. You have to be watching out all the time, because we're being deceived and taken in by the institutions. And what are we going to do? How are we going to break them? You said we cannot, because we've got this mindset of the capitalist process. What we've got to do is to find ways of breaking that somehow first, before we can ever do any process of revolution.
Hang on a second, Simon. Make a contribution in a minute.
You see, that process of upheaval is the process which will break it. And it has to take place. There is an interim process. If tomorrow we had a socialism, well, yes, that is utopianism. It is absolutely. The, in between, the transition has got to take place. A huge, a massive upheaval, millions of people.
Now, did you want to speak on it, Simon?
No.
Not at the moment. All right, okay. Anybody else then?
You off, John?
Well, 12:30 the camp.
All right, please.
Cheerio, John.
Not bad. Cheerio. Nice to see you.
Session, the most exciting one I have to leave here.
All right.
Yeah, next year.
Yeah. We've got to give Peter some time to wind up, and there's 20 minutes left before lunchtime. Is there anything else anybody else wants to say?
Just one new speculation I'd like to make. Yesterday when everybody was talking, the speculation went along the line that the capitalist class would come along and sort of hammer the Socialist Party or the working class if they were getting anywhere near socialism. And here today when we're talking their way around, I've heard that also speculated that the capitalist class might not take that track. They might try to buy us off, and so how would they buy us off? Would they go out of their way to try and solve some of the problems of capitalism and this process of buying us off? Are they going to build us better houses? Are they going to feed the poor? Or what? How are they going to buy us off? So capitalism in its efforts to maintain itself may well try to solve some of the problems of production. I know under the way the capitalist system works are failing at. These are speculations as well, you know, and so you can't actually take different views about what's going to happen here. The whole process, obviously, of socialism has to come about, obviously, from the working class. The working class has got to understand that capitalism can't work for them. They've got to understand why that is so, and obviously have the alternative. And of course, that is still speculation. You know, for the workplace, how are they going to solve it? But it's their problem.
Thank you, Comrade. Right, I think that's everybody then, PC, if you would like to.
Is that last Peter? What's his name?
Comrade Hendry, I don't know his first name.
Peter Hendry.
Peter Hendry.
There's a lot there, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. You've only got 20 minutes, Comrade.
I'll try not to take that long. I mean, I think one of the most interesting contributions from the point of view of the party debate on the history of this question was Simon's, because he put what I would call a traditional opposition to this kind of idea that has been very, very common in the party. And I've got no hesitation in describing that as a kind of sectarian position, because it rests on the idea that you just criticize capitalism and that the whole body of your political contribution